From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Dark Avenger and Hellraiser of cyberspace. We talk with Corey Sandler about his investigation of the computer world's most notorious pranksters and villains, the people who write computer viruses. Also today, Iranian feminist Mahnaz Afkami talks about life in exile. She's the head of a global women's rights group and the author of a new book about other women like herself whose feminist views have forced them to flee their countries. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new album by the trio Bad Religion, and Maureen Corrigan reviews the new 25th anniversary edition of Portnoy's Complaint. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. President Clinton says the U.S. and Russia have agreed to speed up the timetable for dismantling some nuclear warheads. That announcement came just a short time ago as Mr. Clinton and Russian President Boris Yeltsin hold a joint news conference. The two leaders have concluded their two-day summit, signing an economic agreement to remove some trade barriers. UPI's Bill Small reports Yeltsin met earlier today with American business executives, hoping to spur U.S. investment in his country's economy.
As they discussed issues of trade and investment, Presidents Clinton and Yeltsin heard from a handful of American corporate chief executive officers, as well as from former U.S. Ambassador to Moscow Robert Strauss, currently the head of the U.S.-Russia Business Council, who says the meeting went well.
There were no specific commitments given as to anything, but they discussed serious problems and agreed on that solutions to those problems would be pursued.
Among the concerns of American investors in Russia are Russian tax laws and problems there with organized crime. Strauss says any investment carries some risk. Bill Small at the White House.
Officials have called off the search for nearly 800 people who are still missing after an Estonian ferry capsized and sank last night on a run to Sweden. Nearly 1,000 people were aboard, and only 126 survivors have been found. But officials say it is likely that all of those still missing have died. Estonian authorities say they got an SOS from the ferry just before midnight, saying the engines had stopped and the ship was sinking. There is no official explanation yet for the cause, but some Swedish inspectors say there were problems with the front-loading doors on the ferry. 11 CIA officials will be reprimanded for their mistakes in the Ames spy case. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
CIA Director James Woolsey said 11 officials disregarded obvious signs that would have exposed Aldrich Ames as a security risk. Woolsey issued serious reprimands to 4 out of the 11 officials.
Such reprimands would normally accompany dismissal or retirement. 3 of these 4 officers have already retired, and the other will retire within the next few days.
Woolsey said the conditions that allowed Ames to spy for the Soviet Union are systemic to his agency, and no one would be fired for their mistakes. He would name only one person who received a reprimand, Ted Price, Deputy Director of Operations. Price will keep his job. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
The Secretary General of Mexico's ruling party was shot today while leaving a hotel in Mexico City. Jose Francisco Ruiz Maju later died of his wounds. Police have a suspect in custody. On Wall Street just before the close, the Dow Industrials are up just about 10.5 points. This is NPR News in Washington. President Clinton is indicating he will not allow the GATT World Trade Accord to die in a congressional committee this year. U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor says the president will ask Congress to stay in session until it votes on the accord. Earlier today, Senate Commerce Committee Chairman Democrat Ernest Hollings of South Carolina said he would keep the measure bottled up in committee until Congress recesses on October 7th. Under legislative rule, Hollings can delay action for 45 days. Each year, some 4 million people in the U.S. board a cruise ship. A House Maritime panel is looking into just how safe those people are following outbreaks of Legionnaire's disease and dysentery on ships this summer. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
The Centers for Disease Control now traces a Legionnaires outbreak on a celebrity cruise line ship to Whirlpool spas. A CDC official says his agency will be meeting with cruise line officials next month to discuss what can be done to prevent a reoccurrence. An outbreak of dysentery on a Royal Caribbean cruise ship made more than a third of the passengers sick. These incidents, plus a shipboard fire on a third cruise line, have convinced Subcommittee Chairman Walter Lipinski that stricter health and safety standards are needed, especially for foreign-owned ships.
We will find a way to make sure we regulate the safety practices of ships calling on our ports and protect the Americans traveling on the high seas.
The CDC says it's considering making the results of its ship inspections available on the Internet. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
No problems as NASA counts down toward another space shuttle launch scheduled for Friday morning. NASA officials say there's a 7 out of 10 chance the weather will cooperate, and they say Endeavour appears mechanically sound. Last month, the shuttle's main engine shut down just 2 seconds before liftoff. Those engines have been replaced. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Your computer's worst enemy is the virus. A computer virus can destroy all the data on your disk and your hard drive. We have Mother Nature to thank for the flu virus. Computer viruses are created by pranksters and malicious geniuses who take great pride in their accomplishments. They create software programs intended to infect your computer with a code that will replicate in your system and spread an uninvited message or ruin all the work you've done. My guest Corey Sandler has investigated the strange subculture of virus writers for an article in the September issue of PC Computing magazine. Sandler is the author of many books on computers and computer games. He communicated with many virus writers while doing the research for his article. He found a gallery of odd characters. Some of them have taken on forbidding names borrowed from science fiction and fantasy, like Hellraiser and Dark Avenger.
Dark Avenger is probably the most famous, or infamous, depending on how you look at it, practitioner of our current problems, and he has never been identified, although a lot of people have, they believe, come very close to him. He was apparently a computer student in Bulgaria, and he's credited with building the first what's called fast-infecting virus, something which spreads very quickly, often is unnoticed until it's done its damage. And at the time when this first came out, about 4 or 5 years ago, it was not something that was easily detectable. And he went on to do even nastier things, at least in the mythology of viruses. He's also credited with coming up with something called the mutation engine, which was a form of virus which was constantly changing its appearance and its actions, very much like some of the medical models of viruses. And by creating something which was polymorphic, changing its form, it becomes very difficult to detect it.
What about Hellraiser?
Hellraiser was another interesting character. He was one of the founders of a group called Falcon Schism, which is a group of American hackers. And he told me, he said that he was always the rebellious type. He said, I always kind of went to the negative side of things. He said, I was interested in computers just like a lot of my friends, but I was interested in finding things, nasty, dark to do with them. I asked him at one point if he thought that viruses were a form of high-tech graffiti on the wall. And he said to me, yep. He said, yep, I used to do that too. So it was an interesting portrait. And in a way, Hellraiser and Dark Avenger are different ends of the spectrum of virus writers.
Do they represent two different virus cultures?
Yeah, I guess I kind of came to a division into three groups. The first group was what I call the Get a Life gang. These are smart and relatively well-off kids who are essentially out for a lark. I guess if I look back many years to my high school years, I guess these would be the kids in my day and age who used to make stink bombs in science class. These are guys who get their thrills from getting into places they're not supposed to get into and doing things they're not supposed to do, but they're not really necessarily out to destroy things. And many of them have these rather convoluted pseudo-intellectual explanations for what they're up to, things like freedom of expression or academic inquiry or art. But it's clearly, to me, a situation where they're doing it because they can do it and because it's fun.
What's the second group?
The second group are what I call the malevolents. And these are people who are doing it out of anger and envy. Some of them are from America and from Western Europe and the developed world. But a large group of them and a very active group of them, and this is actually pretty scary, are coming out of the third world and Eastern Europe. In a way, it's kind of the downside of the fall of the Iron Curtain. And this is the group that Dark Avenger falls into.
What are they angry about?
Well, think about it. And Dark Avenger, in his contacts with some of the people who have made it through to him, painted a very vivid picture. He's a bright guy. He was a computer programmer. He was in college, but he had no access to computers on his own, and he had no hope of a job. The only chances he got to work on a computer were in very limited situations in Bulgaria, and we're talking at the time of the fall of the Iron Curtain. Bulgaria was an interesting situation because in some respects, Bulgaria became the Soviet Union's Silicon Valley. They were using a lot of the universities there and some factories in Bulgaria to both write the code and produce computers, which were then used in the Soviet Union, not necessarily in Bulgaria. One of the really kind of chilling quotes that Dark Avenger gave to researchers was, he said, the American government can stop me from going to the U.S., but they can't stop my virus. So in a way, this was kind of his way out of the box he felt he was in.
Well, there's a third group of virus writers you wanted to describe.
The third group are what I call the mad bombers. And this is not all that common, but I'm concerned that this is something which will probably be on the increase. And one way to look at these people are people who are out for revenge. Let's say we've got an accountant or even a programmer in a major corporation, and he's got a feud going with his boss. He says, you can't get away with firing me. I'll destroy your corporate database. So you've got people who are capable of putting things like logic bombs into computer systems in offices. You've also, and again, this is not something we've seen a lot of, but some, you've also got corporate spies or industrial saboteurs. I wouldn't be surprised to see these as areas that we'll see more trouble in.
Well, for your article, you went looking for people who create computer viruses. How did you go about finding them?
It was frighteningly easy. I basically just kind of floated a balloon in cyberspace and said, hey, I'm a writer. I'm working on a piece for PC Computing Magazine, and I want to talk to authors of viruses. I also signed on to some of the virus bulletin board systems around the country and left the same kind of messages and tried to engage some of the system operators at the bulletin boards to either speak to me directly or put people through to me. I did that for about a week or two, and then my problem kind of turned around to trying to get all these people to stop messaging me and calling me and let me write the article. I was swamped.
What are the bulletin boards like for the people who actually create the viruses?
Well, here's another very bizarre corner of cyberspace. There are people who, for various reasons, collect viruses. They'll come up with all sorts of excuses. They'll say they're doing it for academic inquiry, or they'll say they're doing it because they can or because it's fun. But what they do is they say, I would like to make my computer a point of exchange for people who are interested in viruses, and if you want to come on and look at the viruses in my collection, you can do that. If you want to put onto my bulletin board, it's called uploading. If you want to upload a virus onto my bulletin board, that's great. And some of the people I spoke to, including guys by the name of Nowhere Man and Aristotle, ended up with collections of several thousand viruses.
Doesn't it kill their computers?
Presumably, they protect their systems with antiviruses. Again, there are some medical analogies here, and what you can do is put your system into quarantine. You can keep these separate from areas where they might infect. You have to be very careful, and I had to be very careful in my own office when I was doing this story.
What's the weirdest virus that you were sent?
I'm not sure that that's really what I was trying to do. I wasn't asking people to send me viruses. I was certainly looking at viruses that are out there. I think some of the stranger viruses are ones which don't actually do damage. They don't go and destroy data, but they'll display a message on your screen. There's a famous virus called Stoned that would just, at the least expected time, display a message on your computer that says, "Your computer is stoned, ha ha ha," you know, and goes away. And then, you know, if you're sitting there at AT&T and working on the spreadsheet, and all of a sudden this pops up on the screen, I mean, it would be a bit surprising.
What are some of the other viruses you found?
Some viruses play little bits of music from your computer at strange times. Other ones are mischievous. They might cause the screen to display in colors that you hadn't expected, and you might spend hours trying to adjust your computer only to find out it's nothing to do with the computer but with this virus that's in your system. There are probably as many types of viruses as there are types of mischief that young people can get into, and I don't think we've come to the end of that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Corey Sandler, and he writes extensively about computers and video games. We're talking about computer viruses. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Corey Sandler, who writes a lot about computers and video games. He has an article in the September issue of PC Computing Magazine about computer viruses and the people who create those viruses. The reason I can see for viruses is that it makes the people who create them really proud because they have this impact on people far away. You know, it must be a big ego thing, but are there other ways that some people benefit from viruses?
Well, I'm not aware of any of the virus writers making money from writing a piece of virus. It's not like writing a hit rock and roll song or a hit book. But if you think about it, and you know, you ask Cicero's classic question, "Qui bono?" Who benefits here? The people who are benefiting are the antivirus makers. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I think that there's a conspiracy among the antivirus makers to create viruses and spread them around, but I will tell you that there are people who believe that. And if you go to one of the conventions of either computer conventions or there are actually conventions of virus writers, you'll hear more conspiracy theories than you'd hear at a Who Shot JFK convention.
Whether the people creating antiviral programs are also contributing to the spread of viruses?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be intentional. It doesn't mean that the author of an antivirus program is sitting down and writing a virus. But we spoke earlier about these virus bulletin board systems. One of the ways in which they work is that in order to sign on to a bulletin board, you will often have what's called a ratio. In order to get onto this system, you have to load something onto the system that I haven't seen already. Remember, these are supposed collectors of viruses. So they would say, if you want to look at my collection of new viruses, you've got to give me one I don't have. Well, the antivirus makers, and this was certainly told to me by some of the operators of bulletin board systems, are among their most common clients. People are signing on, seeing what is available, what is new in the virus community, and then going back and writing antivirus software to combat it. But by merely by participating in the bulletin boards and the way they're doing, they could be seen as helping to spread them. One of the antivirus makers, and this was a bit of a controversial thing at the time, actually was offering money to people who brought them viruses that they hadn't seen before. And I can see a very short leap from that to someone sitting down and saying, hey, I'm going to make $500 this weekend by writing a virus.
There's a culture that surrounds the creating of computer viruses, but then you've got this other culture, which is the computer police, the detectives who track down the people who are creating the viruses. What did you find out about the computer police?
Well, there are a number of researchers in the academic community and some people in both national security departments in the United States and FBI when it crosses the line, who are constantly chasing after some of these people. One of the most famous of the antivirus researchers is a guy by the name of Veselin Bonchev, who, interestingly, is from Bulgaria. He's the former director of the Laboratory of Computer Virology at the Bulgarian Academy of Sciences in Sofia, which is, again, according to the mythology, where Dark Avenger was. He is now in Hamburg, Germany, at the Virus Test Center at the University of Hamburg. And speaking of conspiracies, as we were, there are some people who say that Veselin Bonchev is Dark Avenger. I don't have any way of knowing this one way or another, except that he denies that when you ask him about it, and he is certainly very active right now in the antivirus community. But Bonchev and a number of people like him have devoted much of the last 4, 5, 6 years to tracking the spread of viruses, finding out what they can about the viruses, and then trying to find out what they can about the authors of the viruses. Bonchev was one of the people I spoke with for this piece.
Some of the viruses are coming from other countries, you know, and computers are internationally connected now. Is there any body of international law that makes creating viruses illegal?
There is very little, if anything. Some of the countries in the developed world have cooperative agreements among their police agencies, which would allow them to track it down. But let's stop and say we've talked about Bulgaria. How much does the United States agree on with Bulgaria about anything? I suspect it's very little. One of the interesting things is that in the very difficult crime bill, which President Clinton did manage to get passed this past summer, there was a provision which was putting in penalties for intentionally destroying data or causing problems. I don't believe it has been tested as yet, but that is one recent addition to American law.
Is that the only law in America?
There are certainly laws against causing damages to military installations and causing damages to national security issues. And certainly if you have a corporation which has damages, they could go after someone on a civil basis. But this is again, using a computer term about programming, this is like nailing Jell-O to the wall. It's very difficult to find out the source, exactly how something got infected. It's very difficult to deal with issues of liability. I mean, who is responsible? Is the company responsible for a breach of its own policies by an employee who brought in a virus from his kid's computer at home and drove the computer at work to its knees?
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us about computer viruses.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Corey Sandler's article on computer viruses was published in the September edition of PC Computing Magazine. Twelve years ago, the Los Angeles hardcore band Bad Religion released its first album called How Can Hell Be Any Worse? It was filled with a vague but powerful anger. Over the years, Bad Religion has become more musically adept and more politicized. The group released a single with Noam Chomsky during the Gulf War. Their new album, Stranger Than Fiction, is their first for a major label, Atlantic. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Bad Religion is everything I like in a loud rock band. This quintet marshals its standard three chords into big, colorful smears of sound. The singer bellows lyrics that have content if you want to figure it out, but you can just appreciate his voice as music and go with the blare if you like. A lot of what Bad Religion has to say taps into the insecurity of adolescence. That's what the song I just played, called Incomplete, hammers away at. But increasingly, this band of grown-ups, three of the band members are now fathers themselves, is intent on making its despair more universal.
Obituary. Oh yeah, cockroach nests, rattling traps. How many devils can you fit up on a matchet? Curiosity killed the Kerouac cat. Sometimes truth is stranger than fiction.
On Stranger Than Fiction, the album's title song, singer Greg Graffin yells, "Life is the crummiest book I ever read. There isn't a hook, just a lot of cheap shots, pictures to shock, and characters an amateur would never dream up." The nice thing about this, their eighth album, is that it proves the extent to which Bad Religion are no longer amateurs themselves. When Bad Religion first began, it was part of a Los Angeles movement, a kind of musical nihilism that happened in a town ruled by the show business industry, in which the idea was to make music so ugly that it could never be co-opted as Hollywood entertainment. But Greg Graffin is no dummy. In fact, these days he's a teaching assistant at Cornell working on a PhD in biology. He knows that sooner or later, everything good gets co-opted as entertainment, and has turned the latest Bad Religion album into an honorable example of it.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Stranger Than Fiction by the band Bad Religion. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I'm sorry about the sun. How could I know that you would burn? I'm sorry about the moon. How could I know that you disapprove?
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Iranian feminist Manaz Afkami knows what it's like to live in exile. She left Iran 15 years ago when it became too dangerous for her to continue her work for women's rights. Her new book is about other women who have been forced to flee their countries. We'll talk about life in exile and about Afkami's work with the International Women's Movement. And Maureen Carrigan reviews the 25th anniversary edition of Philip Roth's novel, Portnoy's Complaint. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Nearly 800 people are missing and feared dead after an Estonian ferry boat sank last night in the Baltic Sea. Nearly 1,000 people were on board the ship, and fewer than 150 have been rescued. The ship was on a run from Tallinn, Estonia to Stockholm, Sweden when it radioed an SOS that it was sinking. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports there is no official explanation yet on what caused the disaster.
There was a claim by a Swedish maritime official, Anders Lindström, that an inspection of the seals on the doors, the car deck doors, had shown that they were faulty and that this had actually been carried out as recently as yesterday. But that's just an allegation that has not brought forth any official comment from Estline, the company which actually ran the ferry.
NPR's Michael Goldfarb reporting from Stockholm. President Clinton and Russian President Boris Yeltsin have agreed to move up the timetable for dismantling their nuclear arsenals. That announcement came a short time ago as the two leaders began a joint news conference ending their two-day summit. The two presidents signed several agreements this afternoon, including one which pledges closer economic ties. Talks are underway at a General Motors complex in Flint, Michigan, where more than 11,000 workers walked off the job yesterday in a dispute over working conditions and overtime. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
The strike against the Buick complex in Flint is now in its second day. The union says the company needs to hire more workers. That would allow GM to slow down the line speed and cut back on some of the mandatory overtime. But GM needs to improve its productivity and keep its costs down, so the company is reluctant to bring more people on. Today's Detroit News reports that the company did agree yesterday to increase employment levels somewhat, but would not agree to slow down the lines in Flint. That's when talks broke down and the walkout began. Already some GM plants, which depend on the Flint complex for parts, are being shut down. Analysts say parts shortages could force the layoff of more than 200,000 auto workers within days. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
President Clinton says if the Senate does not pass the GATT trade agreement before adjourning in October, he will ask senators to come back after the November 8th election to take up the matter. The president says the U.S. Congress must pass GATT this year. Earlier today, South Carolina Democrat Senator Ernest Hollings threatened to keep the treaty tied up in committee until the end of the session. He chairs the Senate Commerce Committee. The Commerce Department reports durable goods posted their biggest rise in nearly 2 years last month. The 6% increase was led by a high demand for automobiles and parts. The August increase follows a decline of 4% in July. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher, the Dow gaining 15.14 points. This is NPR News in Washington. A congressional committee has approved a bill setting a March 1st deadline for U.S. troops to end their mission to Haiti. The measure cleared the House Foreign Affairs Committee today by a vote of 27-18, but it's a long way from becoming law. It would have to clear Congress in the remaining few weeks of the session, and President Clinton would have to sign it. Defense Department officials have argued that a set deadline would hamper the U.S. mission in Haiti. Federal health officials are meeting planes arriving from India to determine whether passengers are carrying the pneumonic plague. Travelers from India have found themselves unwelcome in several countries. Bruce Dorton of Peach State Public Radio reports.
Federal health officials began meeting the planes yesterday, but haven't yet found any cases of the disease, which has killed at least 54 people in India. The disease is spread by fleas that have bitten rats or is spread person to person by airborne bacteria. Tom Skinner is spokesman for the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. He says seven major U.S. airports are being monitored.
In New York, Miami, Chicago, Seattle, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Honolulu.
Skinner says if any cases are found at U.S. airports, the infected person would be quarantined and other passengers from the flight would be monitored. Skinner also says passengers on flights from India will get information cards telling them what to do if they get sick. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Atlanta.
The judge in the O.J. Simpson case has turned down a prosecution request to delay jury selection in the trial. Prosecutors wanted to send potential jurors home for up to a month while the court heard arguments on the admissibility of DNA evidence. But Judge Lance Ito said that would inconvenience citizens who are volunteering for jury service. Meanwhile, jury selection continues to move more quickly than the judge had expected, and the first phase may be completed by the end of the day. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Manaz Afkami was forced out of Iran 15 years ago because of her women's rights work. She lives in exile in the United States, where she now directs the Sisterhood is Global Institute and serves on the Advisory Committee on Women for Human Rights Watch. Her new book, Women in Exile, is about other women who, like herself, have been forced out of their countries. I asked why she wanted to write about other women in exile.
The experience of exile for me was such a traumatic experience, and I spent so much of my initial weeks and months in this country thinking about it and trying to cope with it and trying to somehow come to terms with it, that I came to see that unless I was able to take my self-absorption, shall we say, in this regard, outside and try to learn from others, from other people's experiences, I was not going to be able to cope with this condition and try to learn to adjust to it and to lead a positive life. So it was mostly really a learning experience initially. I sort of drifted into it in some ways in the sense that I came across women who have had the same experience, who shared the same experience, and through talking to them, I began thinking there was so much that we shared, so much that was similar in our experiences.
Did you find that there were things the women you interviewed had in common, no matter what culture they were from?
Absolutely, yes. It seemed astonishing that no matter whether the woman was from Cambodia or China or Afghanistan, so much was similar in the way they were brought up. For one thing, the idea of a society or a community trying to, in some ways, limit and control a woman's area or space. And in a sense, you know, talking to the women from these 12 different countries, I came to realize that women are perhaps in exile even in their own homelands, in the sense that they're in exile from the political arena, they're in exile from the social arena, from the public sphere, from certain economic endeavors. And in that sense, they somehow learn to use the coping mechanisms that they have used at home when they come abroad.
I'm interested in the events that sent you into exile. Before you were in exile, you had been in the cabinet in Iran as the Minister of State for Women's Affairs.
Yes.
What happened that sent you into exile?
Well, actually, the situation in Iran was changing rapidly the last few months that I was in the country. And the fundamentalist revolutionaries were becoming more and more strengthened in their activities and in their political demonstrations and opposition to the regime. I, at that time, however, was involved in setting up or helping to set up an international center for the advancement of women, which was a UN institution. And I came to the United States in order to finalize that agreement. The UN, being a little slower than it usually is expected, the process took longer. And in the few weeks that I was spending here, it became apparent that I couldn't go back. And so something that was supposed to be a short business trip ended up to be a long 15-year life in exile.
When you were in New York on business with the United Nations, you got a phone call from your husband telling you not to come back to Iran. What had changed in Iran?
The revolution had actually accelerated. The fundamentalist forces had gained strength. And the regime who was in control then, or marginally in control, was in fact somehow scapegoating some of the elements who were objects of the fundamentalist opposition. The women, of course, were at the top of that list, and activist women such as myself were very much targeted. So the government, in fact, was trying to give in on these areas as quickly as possible, so that perhaps to try to stop the tide of the revolution. That's why a few months even prior to all this, I had lost the position of Minister of State for Women's Affairs. So I was told that if I went to Iran, I would be arrested by the government at that time, which was a military government, in fact. And, of course, subsequently, as it happened in the case of many of my colleagues, when the fundamentalists came to power, the first group who would be persecuted and, in some cases, executed would be the ones who were already taken by the previous regime and put in jail.
Now, I believe the Iranian government charged you with corruption. This is the revolutionary government.
Yes.
Charged you with corruption on earth and warring with God. What does that mean?
That is the standard charge against whoever is deemed to be not within the confines of what the fundamentalists believe to be the right way to live or behave.
When you were in New York and you got that phone call from your husband saying you can't come back to Iran, and all of a sudden you were in exile, you were never going to go home again.
Yes.
What went through your mind? Did you change? Did you think, now I'm a different person than the person I was a minute ago?
Yes, I think that's the most immediate and the most shocking aspect of being forced into exile. That is that a whole set of things, a whole number of phenomena which define one's identity are suddenly taken away. The whole context of one's being is shattered. You have to start all over again, redefining, reshaping not only your external life, but the self who's at the center of all that. Who am I now that I am not the person that I was? So I think that this is the essence of the exile experience, is this question of how to deal with one's identity. And I think every one of the stories in the book also define that is the point to that as the central experience of exile. And both the loss and the reconstruction are, I think, the central theme of living in exile.
My guest is Manaz Afkami, author of the new book, Women in Exile. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Manaz Afkami. She's an Iranian feminist living in exile in the United States. What were some of the issues you organized around in Iran when you were active in the women's movement there?
Well, you know, a group of us who were working originally with the University Women's Association and then with the Women's Organization of Iran, we tried to see from the women themselves what it was that they wanted to deal with. And it seemed more and more apparent that the main issue that women wanted to deal with was economic self-sufficiency. that they consider that the root of their problems and also the root of their solution, in the sense that if they were self-sufficient, they could begin to seek other rights, and if they were not, all other rights would be sort of utopian and abstract. So that's actually, we began with stressing that, stressing what would lead to economic self-sufficiency, that is literacy and training and vocational training and the kind of education which would lead to this particular end.
Now, you've criticized the international women's movement and the left in general for not being quick enough to condemn Islamic fundamentalism in Iran.
Yes. Yes, and I think I have that problem even now, you see. It's not that I'm criticizing the movement in general, but there are trends that are trying to be, in the best sense of the word, sensitized to diversity and sensitized to difference, which I admire a lot, and I myself am very much appreciative of. But to take the kind of thing which has meaning in this society especially, you see, where we have different ethnic minorities with their rights and their needs for self-assertion, to take this out of context and try to apply it to other societies who do not have the protections, legal and judicial and constitutional protections of civil rights which exist in this country, I think it's misguided. That a sort of wish for diversity is wonderful if everyone can express oneself within a context. But you see, when you take that and support the right of certain groups to assertion, the difficulty becomes then that takes the right from all other groups for self-assertion.
Well, you know, the debate in the United States, for instance, among feminists has been... is it cultural imperialism to accuse another culture of subjugating women? Or are we projecting our Western values onto their culture?
Yeah, and that's exactly what I have problems with, you see. It's every culture has problems with the role of women. Through the years, in every culture, there has been a system of interaction between genders which has been subjugating one's gender and having different roles for the sexes, to the detriment of one sex. Every country has experienced that. Every culture is trying to deal with that as times change, as societies change. These practices evolve and change, and there is a dynamic nature to them. To think that in some cultures this is the way they are because that's their culture, if they have four wives or if they beat their wives or if they mutilate their little girls, this is simply their culture and they are doomed to have it forever, I think is a sort of a reverse colonialism. There's one set of values for us and another set of values for others. And I think that is not helpful to anybody. The opposite of it is not that one must take Western values and Western priorities and try to implement them in other countries. The idea is to fully appreciate diversity and fully appreciate differences of expression socially and in every other way. But there are basic rights that each human being can strive to have, and how they strategize it depends on the culture. But every culture is dynamic and should change. In this country, 30 years ago, blacks and whites had to eat in separate places. The culture had to change.
There is now a fatwa, a death warrant, on the life of Taslina Nasrin, who is a woman from Bangladesh, who's a writer and a doctor, and she's living in exile now. Islamic fundamentalists have attacked her for her writing. She's a feminist. Some of her writing is very sexual. What is your group, the Sisterhood is Global Institute, doing on her behalf?
We're working on behalf of women's human rights and their rights to express themselves. Of course, in the case of Taslima, is the same thing. That is an expansion of the same ideas and efforts to make sure that people can say what they have to say and the price is not put on their heads. The expounding of the ideas that there should be variety of expression in society, and people should have a right to say that, and that people should not be accused without recourse.
Are you are you working with her personally?
No, actually, we're not. You know, she's her life is in danger, and she is in hiding. And I don't think it's safe to be communicating too much with her. We have worked with groups who tried to get her out of the country, and we are, I think, trying to do as much as possible in terms of saying what her rights are as a person. To say what she has to say without being, without having a price on her head.
There's a recent Canadian law that offers guidelines for gender-based persecution.
Yes.
Would you explain what that law is?
Well, that law, as a matter of fact, my organization, the Sisterhoodies Global Institute, was active also in promoting that and in getting information for the Canadian immigration on that. And we're also following the same in the United States. The idea is that in certain countries, simply being a woman can be dangerous to your health, in the sense that you don't need to do any particular thing. You don't have to be politically active against the system, the various usual grounds for asylum. Simply being a woman is acting as a person can be dangerous. And so if you seek asylum simply on the grounds that in such a country as, let's say, Saudi Arabia, being a woman is dangerous, your case should be considered. Now, by being a woman, I mean being a woman and not agreeing to subjugate yourself to the particular limitations that are set upon you.
Manaz Afkami is the author of Women in Exile, published by University Press of Virginia. She directs the Sisterhoodies Global Institute in Bethesda, Maryland. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what's the news from the CIA?
The CIA has acted in the matter of the Aldridge Ames spy case, Terry, and I think the most surprising thing is how little they did. A series of reprimands, which may not change very much. We'll talk about what it means and why more hasn't happened. Also, we'll be covering the story of the ferry which sank off the coast of Finland with great loss of life. The Haitian Parliament meets today, and Alan Tomlinson is there. We're following up some stories. Health care, the general agreement on tariffs and trade, is apparently off for the year, and the president's hopping mad about it. We'll be following the plague story in India and continuing on the death penalty. And we have Oscar Peterson and Itzhak Perlman tonight.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's been 25 years since Philip Roth's sexual coming-of-age novel Portnoy's Complaint was first published. Vintage Books has just come out with an anniversary edition that includes a new afterword by Roth. Critic Maureen Corrigan took the opportunity to read the novel for the first time.
I was watching the news the night after Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis died last May. One reporter standing outside Jackie's apartment house was asking passers-by how they would remember her. Most mentioned her beauty, grace, and class, but one woman shook her head and said, "Jackie was a lovely lady, but oy, the life she had." I recognized that woman's voice instantly. It was the voice of the New York of my youth, where a lot of people, many, like me, not even Jewish, spoke a dialect shaped by Yiddish expressions and woeful worldviews. I remember thinking, that voice is fading out. In the next century, New York won't sound like that anymore. So one of the great pleasures of reading Portnoy's Complaint is listening to Alexander Portnoy talk. His voice was forged out of that epic clash between the cadences of the shtetl and the greater New York, New Jersey city streets. But Portnoy's voice also carries far beyond its origins. It's one of the most compelling, comic eye voices in all of literature, right up there with the manic monologues of Chaucer's Pilgrims, Sterne's Tristram Shandy, and Huck Finn. Here, for instance, is a monumental Portnoy rant. Let me apologize in advance if I get carried away, but Roth's rhythms are infectious. Portnoy here is mimicking one of his mother's typical reports about a successful son of the old neighborhood. Do you remember Seymour Schmuck, Alex? Well, Seymour is now the biggest brain surgeon in the entire Western Hemisphere. Last year, with his wife and his two little daughters, he took them all to Europe for an $80 million tour of 7,000 countries, some of them you never even heard of, that they made just to honor Seymour. And on top of that, he's so important, Seymour, that in every single city in Europe that they visited, he was asked by the mayor himself to stop and do an impossible operation on a brain in hospitals that they also built for him right on the spot. And listen to this, where they pumped into the operating room the theme song from Exodus, so everybody should know what religion he is. And that's how big your friend Seymour is today, and how happy he makes his parents. You can see why Portnoy has problems. Portnoy's complaint, you might remember, is fashioned as a novel-length soliloquy spoken by Portnoy to his shrink. During the marathon session, Portnoy discusses his constipated father, his obsession with schickses, and masturbation, the only activity the adolescent Portnoy managed to hide from his all-prying mother. Back in 1969, masturbation was a taboo topic. Now it's the subject of Seinfeld episodes. Another thing Philip Roth was denounced for when the novel was first published was Portnoy's self-hatred as a Jew. Well, great novelists usually aren't PR spokespersons for their own kind. They're spies, saboteurs, secret agents. James Joyce caught hell for his portrait of the Irish. So did Toni Morrison for telling shameful racial secrets in The Bluest Eye. In his new book on the canon, Harold Bloom lists no fewer than 9 books by Philip Roth as essential reading. Some critics say that's because Roth and Bloom are pals. I don't know Philip Roth from Adam, but it seems to me he's earned his hot seat among the great masters of literature all on his own.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, rethinking religion and its place in political discourse. We talk with evangelical Christian Jim Wallace, founder of Sojourners Magazine, and Michael Lerner, a member of the Jewish Renewal Movement and editor of Tikkun Magazine. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.